Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacey Toth, best-selling author and co-creator of PaleoParents.com, where we focus on real-life solutions for families seeking health.
I'm Dr. Sarah Ballantyne, New York Times best-selling author and creator of ThePaleoMom.com. I'm passionate about improving scientific literacy around public health topics.
I like hashtags and bone broth.
And I'm just a super nerd.
Welcome to the Paleo View, everybody, where this week we are live and in person.
I know, and Stacey's making eye contact with me. You
so
can
awkward.
Already tell she's really awkward.
So awkward.
Yeah, I'm just going to like stare at you this whole time.
And we're it's like we're physically touching. You know how I feel about that. I know.
Aww.
Another hug. So, for those of you who are listening, we are doing this live on both Instagram and Facebook, but we wanted to record it for those of you who listen to podcast platform to be informed of the questions. So, we're going to take questions live, and we've already got some rolling in. So, first and foremost, I'm just going to kind of recap everybody. I just got back from the cruise this week. We did a week in the Caribbean, and I think I will probably do like a blog post on how to eat on a cruise, because that's the question I've been getting most often is like, how do you navigate that? And it was pretty easy for the most part. I would say the first question that I got was, how's my back? I did an excursion in Jamaica, which was our very first excursion. And they put these warnings on excursions like, if you have a bad back or if you're pregnant, don't do this. And I didn't listen to that. And so we hiked Dunn River Falls, which is like, you know, a waterfall with wet rocks. Not the best life choice for a bad back. And I had just fallen in the parking lot. I missed a speed bump and literally just like, and so I think between the two, my back just gave out about halfway through the falls. And so the cruise was interesting with a bad back,
yeah.
But It's the worst flare that I've had since I injured it, I think like 2 years ago. So, I've been able to function, and we went to Science Museum today. I've been able to walk around and stuff like that. So
you were not dragging a limp leg behind you?
No, I'm learning how to manage it and, to rest at certain points and do that kind of stuff. So my back is injured, but, still functional. So thanks for those who are asking. Okay, so I think we're getting a lot of, like, food questions.
Look at all of the food for kids questions.
Yes.
You have three questions on Instagram. You're
going
to have to scroll up.
So we've got this one.
All right, so Cole has joined us, and the first question on Instagram, can you really wash vitamin D off after being in the sun? Love you, ladies. What does that mean?
So as you go outside, you basically are making vitamin D from cholesterol mm-hmm. in your skin, and the reaction is triggered by UVB radiation from the sun. And there's this sort of myth that if you shower too soon after being out in the sun, that you will, like, basically lose vitamin D.
She's live now.
This is real life.
And I don't actually know if that's true or not. Like, I know what the question is asking, so the idea of, like, showering too soon after being inside, you won't make as much vitamin D in your skin.
Yeah, that's what I would assume. It's not entirely, because you've got to start to have made it when you were in the sun.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine that if you are, you know, it's like it's an energy-driven reaction. So you think about how much energy water soaks up. You could kind of imagine that you are losing some of that energy mm-hmm. in water, and it would inhibit it a little bit. But I don't actually know the answer to that question.
Stumped to Sarah. I'm sure that we can Google it or something later. But
Mommy, you have a question rolling in from a so-called Wesley.
Mm-hmm. Can you please help Wesley find Daddy so that we can continue?
Yeah.
Okay. Next one. University for Nutritional Science. How would you handle your professor promoting Weight Watchers and low fat? It looks like there's more text there that we can't read, but or maybe that's just the microphone.
Paleo treats
Okay.
So My recommendation, which is the recommendation that I, you know, have also heard from people who have gone through programs, whether it's sort of a registered dietitian or your nutrition, is just bite your tongue. It's not a battle worth fighting. Learn what you're supposed to know, pass your exams with flying colors, and then actually educate yourself and wait until you've got that certification and then be assertive and tell people what's what. But,
You have to pass the tests.
You have to pass the tests, and being argumentative with the professor is not going to help you in school, and you're going to be able to do so much more with that degree on the other side. So, as hard as it is to know that what you're being taught is actually wrong, outdated, you know, not accurate, at the end of the day, the professor's in charge, and you don't want to fail.
It's kind of what I tell my kids about learning the food, my food
That's
plate
what I tell
in school,
my kids.
Right? I'm like, I know they're going to tell you that you need milk. We know that you don't need milk, but you need to answer the question. You need milk. So, okay. Some more from Facebook.
Yeah. So we've got easy lunches to pack for school. So my kids like the same thing every single day. Yeah, I know. This is like a running joke because my kids love the... We actually now get the Trader Joe's organic grass-fed beef hot dogs because they're the cheapest and they're really good. And they actually don't have nightshades.
Really?
Yeah. So that's also... I mean, I don't eat them still, but I could.
Yeah.
My kids like those cold right out of the package. I know people think that's gross, but that's basically what bologna is in a different shape.
Yeah.
So if you just think about it, it's like bologna as a tube... instead of a slice, then it's not so gross anymore. But that's their like favorite thing. And then they have carrots, celery, cucumber, and typically some kind of fruit. So they sort of rotate between grapes and apples and oranges and berries. And that's their like go-to lunch every single day. On the weekends when we're home, we mix it up a little bit more. But then it might be like canned fish. My youngest daughter, Mira, loved canned fish and would brought it to school like every single day through like kindergarten, and then I think she started getting teased.
Yeah.
And
that's exactly what happened, Nicole.
She didn't want to bring canned fish.
The stinky lunches, the seaweed, the canned fish, that kind
she
of stuff.
She still likes seaweed if I pack seaweed in her lunch, so I don't know if she doesn't have the same association with that, but she was getting teased, I think, with canned fish.
And, yeah.
And so now she has it on the weekend.
My kids really like leftovers, especially if we do roasted chicken. So we always, if we do chicken legs or thighs, like triple the amount that we would eat so that they can take chicken legs.
That's a lot of food.
Right. Sarah's been cooking for all of us this week, and both of our families, it's 9 people, and my boys are not shy with food.
No, but my girls eat a lot too now. Yeah. Like they have hefty appetites.
Yeah, so we do like 2 whole family packs. We get the Whole Foods chicken is like our favorite chicken if we don't have it from the farm or something. And they do like a legs thigh combo family pack, and we do 2 whole ones of those on 2 trays.
Those are like 5 or 6 pounds for one family pack. Yeah. That's a lot of chicken.
But it means that the boys just grab a chicken leg or a thigh and put it in their lunches, and all week long they do that, which is more affordable than the other options that they like, which are...
it's more affordable than hot dogs.
Lunch meats. Yeah. Like, that's their other favorite. They really like roast beef, and they'll roll different things up in roast beef, whether it's mustard or cheese or whatever. They'll just, like, roll it up. They don't need anything else with it. They also like...
the meat becomes the... like tortilla.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, you're putting stuff in the meat instead of the meat in something else.
Yes. And they also really like ham, which you can find like even at Costco now or Whole Foods, like different kinds of high quality ham and turkey. Those are the lunch meats of their choice.
We've also done hard-boiled eggs. That's been that's a lunch that my kids still like from time to time.
My kids still really like hard-boiled eggs. They like egg salad, but they don't like hard-boiled eggs.
Adele's, like, breakfast kick right now is hard-boiled eggs and a homemade waffle. Mm. So, like, that's her, like, her... that's the thing she wants to eat every single day. Yeah. Mira's more... She is more of my meat eater. It's funny, actually. She's the person who, like, we put the plate in front of her, she will eat all the vegetables first and then the meat last. But if you gave her the choice between a meat-based meal and like an egg-based meal, she would always pick the meat-based meal.
The other things that we throw in the boys' lunches, they really like individual olives. I know that's weird. We get them on Amazon Prime, and it's a great vegetable and a fat to throw into their lunch, and I try to always make sure that they have something like that, baby carrots or cut up, if you can like pre-cut up rainbow carrots for them. For me, for us, our boys all are responsible for packing their own lunches. Mm-hmm. So we try to prepare things in advance so that in the mornings they can just like grab a handful of baby carrots or whatever it is they're going to do. And I would say maybe once or twice a week we end up doing Wesley's for him because he just like can't get himself together in time. But my boys are of an age now where they're almost entirely packing their own lunches. And then for a carb, they either do like a fruit or we do plantain chips or avocado oil, like sweet potato or regular potato chips, something to kind of fill it out. And then they also grab a snack, and their favorite snack are meat sticks. So they like Rome. What are the bacon ones that you like? Hold the pork ones. It's Rome sticks, chomps. Are those the two that you like? Yeah, those are the ones I like.
We didn't get your voice on audio there.
He head nodded.
Yeah. Note for the record, Cole provided a head nod.
They cannot get enough of those Rome sticks. So the difference between Rome sticks and any other meat stick is that it's made out of bacon. It's made out of pork, and so it's bacon flavored, as opposed to most beef sticks, which are beef based
and have a more like a pepperoni-ish type
yes.
feel.
Yeah. And so the reason we actually got them originally is because they're nightshade free, and there's one that's made with pineapple, so it has like a little bit of sugar, but I think it's like 2 grams or
so
something.
My kids really like the Epic snack sticks. Mm. So they don't like neither one of them like jerky-ish type things that are too chewy. Mm-hmm. And the snack sticks kind of cross the, they're not soft like the Epic bars, mm-hmm. but they're not super chewy like jerky.
Yeah.
And Adele loves the salmon ones. Like, that's her total favorite. And Mira likes the turkey ones, which do have bell pepper in them, mm-hmm. but are otherwise, they're not spicy in any way. That's a really common snack for them. And Mira has taken to, as I have, the new Epic Baked Pork Rinds.
We are just having a debate about this at lunch today.
They're so good. And we have, since they came out a month ago, I think we've gone through 4 cases.
So I really like the original classic Epic pork rinds that are fried, but I like the flavor of just the pink Himalayan sea salt ones of the new ones that are baked.
I
know, she loves baked ones.
I really do.
I mean,
you say tomato, I say tomato.
It's fine. They're both good. Enjoy them both. But yeah, the boys like those as well. We have a ton of those. And they really like for breakfast, actually, maple ones. You've had those, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, those are really good for breakfast.
I'm a person who, most of the time, there's, I guess, a few exceptions, I don't like sweet with salty. Mm. So,
that's not normal.
I'm more of like when it's something like that, when it's got that little bit of a sugar to it, I don't enjoy it as much as if it's straight salt.
I like that one because it's not super sugary. It doesn't have a lot of like grams of sugar, but it is a little sweet. You know, it's maple flavor.
Oh, it doesn't
flavor.
Really have very many carb grams in it at all.
No, I think it's like one or two.
Yeah, it's not, but it does have that little bit of a sweet flavor.
Those are my favorite. Okay, we've answered that. I know people have asked me about eating paleo, especially with kids on the cruise, and I'm just going to do kind of a dedicated thing because I feel like that would be too lengthy to get into.
I think it would be a really good like resource for people because I think cruise vacations is a thing that lots of people do, and especially in our community, a lot of people worry about how they're going to navigate that. You're like trapped on a boat.
Yeah, I
assume that's what it is. You're just like in a cell.
Yeah,
in a boat.
Definitely. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
A 9x9 box.
That's what I. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's my entire impression of what cruises are like. Please don't educate me.
So I will do a dedicated resource. I will. Just really quick, the thing about it is you, when you sign up for a cruise, you have the option to say if you have any food intolerances if you're going on most cruise lines. So for me in particular, what I signed up for when we registered is I established the whole family, all 5 of us, because we were in 2 separate rooms, as gluten I don't remember if it was like gluten sensitive or whatever, you know, I just checked the box, like we don't eat gluten. And then I also put a note about nightshades and corn for myself. And so when you go to cruise dining, you have usually three options. One, it's an open buffet and you have no hope there. Don't go. Just like nobody will be able to tell you anything about the food that you're eating at the buffet. It's a nightmare.
People said the hot dogs and burgers had gluten.
The first day on the ship was difficult. And, you know, we had been standing in line for like 3 hours. And it was this whole big thing. And so it was like, oh, we'll just go to the buffet and we'll get bunless burgers and we'll get hot dogs. And we got, you know, scrambled eggs and sausage or, you know, whatever it was. Things that should be totally safe. Yeah. And I totally got gluten. Like, I could tell that I was gluten immediately. And so the next day when we were at... The other two options that you have are both sit-down dining. One is it's what they call free dining, which you just go in and you sit down and you give them your room number. And if you're registered for a special diet, then the special diet comes up when you give them your room number and they'll tell you what your options are. The other option is like you can upgrade your meal by going to like one of a couple of restaurants on most cruise ships that are more high end. But I'll tell you, it's not even worth the money. Like we did a package where we got a couple of those meals, and it wasn't even worth like what it would have cost to do that, because the open dining is really nice, good food, and they took such good care of us. Like, they knew who we were when we came in, and they knew what our limitations were, and they would give us the menu for the following breakfast and the following dinner, and we would pre-order. So the next day when we came in, like, our food was already kind of pre-prepped, and dinner was more quick than it was for other people, and that kind of stuff. So we gave the person, the special diet person, a nice tip at the end of the cruise. I would recommend that you do that if you get, you know, taken care of by someone. But whatever your issues are, like we were with someone who had a severe egg allergy for her son, and that was taken care of. So whatever the restrictions are, you can totally work it if you plan and you tell people and that kind of stuff. So we will do a resource with kind of recapping those instructions and different things like that. But this is my third cruise ship, all three different lines, and all of them work the same way. And I didn't have issues, except when I ate at the buffet. So just don't do that.
This is also where I, like, if I get asked a question about eating a special diet and traveling, where I always sort of remind people that it's a lot easier to do this type of thing once you've played with reintroductions and you have a really good sense of where your lines are that you can't cross, right? So you know you're fine with dairy and you're fine with rice. Like, you can do some gluten-free grains. Like, you figured out through trial and error, here's the things I absolutely can't do, and here's the things that I can get away with on a vacation or once in a while for a treat. And that once you're, like, that at that point in your sort of health journey, navigating restaurants and parties and social situations and travel and whatever, all of those things become much easier just because you know the lines that you can cross and the lines that you really need to stay on your side.
I think that it could be done AIP, honestly, with the amount of meat and fish, with the exception of fats. And that's the one thing that I tell people is, like, you know, if you're past 30 days of AIP and you want to stick to everything, you're not ready to reintroduce. I think if you're able to let go of, like, the fats being not 100%.
And some people are differently sensitive to that. Yeah. Like, some people really have a hard time with canola oil, and some people, you know, can.
And I think that would be, I don't know personally, but I think that would probably be more difficult to navigate just, you know, from the way they're cooking things back there. So. All right, what's next?
All right, I know you both have hashies. What are the top two things that you've implemented that have made the biggest difference in how you feel with thyroid disease?
Wow.
I like that question.
That's a biggie. So, I mean, it goes without saying that diet is number one. So I'm not going to include that as top two because I just feel like that goes without saying. So the other two for me... We're definitely learning to manage my stress, and that's such, like, a nebulous thing. But
there's such a strong link between stress and thyroid function. Like, it's so crazy.
It took me over a year to, like, figure this out. Like, I know, oh, I manage my stress. Like, no, I had to literally change the way we ran the blog. I had to let go of the team. I had to, like, not do books anymore. I literally had to change my life and the way that I was functioning in order to reduce my stress from that capacity. And I had to also really start to focus on thinking positively and starting to like find the good in things and embrace and not try to get bogged down in the negative all the time. Like those were really big for me from an outlook perspective, for my overall kind of health and well-being. And I started that process when you were writing the Paleo Approach, because I remember you introducing the idea of how important that was and you saying I needed to meditate. And I was like, I am not going to meditate.
I remember that conversation.
But
I was like, use an app like Calm.
And I laughed. I mean, and I don't, I'm not the kind of person that can do that. But I did find ways in my own life to manage stress. I'm not very good about sleep. I know that that's going to be one of the things that you say. So, I don't know. I guess I'll stick with food and stress. I think the other part of the food coin. Okay, so here's what I'll say about food. It's not just about what you take out; it's what you put in. So, the nutrient dense foods that you need are so important. Not just the foods that you take out of your diet. So, for me, adding things like collagen and broth and seafood and more vegetables and organ meats when I can. I take liver pills every day because I don't get enough organ meat in my regular diet. Those foods, I have to really focus on making sure that I'm introducing them to my diet to feel my best.
So, I sort of feel like autoimmune protocol, diet, and lifestyle is like a given here. So, like... besides all of the things that encompasses, taking thyroid hormone replacement has been really, really great for me. And I know that there's this desire when people first find the autoimmune protocol and they realize that they can really, stop the immune attacks on their own bodies. And there's this idea that, I can, stop being on medication. I can get rid of this. This can no longer be a part of my life. But the problem is if you think about cutting yourself and there's a scar, right, your skin's not the same after a deep cut. And autoimmune disease can be very much the same, but it's internal, so you don't see the scar. And an autoimmune disease that attacks an endocrine organ, it's fairly unusual to be able to regain full function of that organ afterwards. Especially for me, I probably had Hashi's for upwards of 30 years before I was diagnosed. And even though my numbers were never really off, they weren't crazy off. I was only a little bit low. It's taken nearly full replacement level doses of thyroid hormone to get me to just nudge into the normal range. I take a really, really high dose, and it's been 4 years of playing with thyroid hormone doses and formulas to get to a place where I'm feeling really good. So I think that not being afraid of that, not seeing it as failure, not seeing it as a substitute for all of the diet and lifestyle stuff, but not feeling like you're somehow not AIPing hard enough if you have to take a medication. I think that that's a really important thing to kind of wrap our heads around, that supporting an organ that has been damaged from being attacked by the immune system is okay. And so taking thyroid hormone replacement has been one of the best things for me. And thyroid hormone also actually influences immune function. So there's this piece for people with Hashi's where supplementing with thyroid hormone and getting your numbers more in range can actually help you get more sort of bang for your buck out of the AIP, because it's actually helping to make your immune system a little bit more easy to regulate. So there's that whole side of it. And then I would say, that's probably the biggest. I would probably like more generally say working with a functional medicine practitioner to dial things in. Stress is also my biggest challenge. I sometimes get asked in the Autoimmune Protocol Lecture Series, like, why do you do these things? 'Cause I'm very open with like, this is the medication I'm taking. I'm taking this supplement. Like, here's what this is. This is, I've tried this, right? A lot of like, here's this great thing. I've tried it, and here's why it works. And here's the science behind it. And I'll often get asked like, why do you think you still need that? Like, one of the questions I was asked actually this week in the course was, I started taking low dose naltrexone, almost 2 years ago. because I wasn't able to get my C-reactive protein all the way to zero. It was able to come down substantially on the enemy protocol, but there was still, I could get it down to about 2.4, and I couldn't get it all the way down. So I went on low-dose naltrexone, supervised by my functional medicine specialist, and it did get my CRP down to zero. And so the question was, like, why do you think AIP wasn't enough? And I was like, stress! Like, look at all the things I'm doing. And it's always my... I'm really good at saying no to other people's projects, and I'm terrible at saying no to mine. Like, I just come up with all these ideas, and I want to do everything all at once all the time. So I think that sort of given that I have accepted this aspect of healthy living, that I've just decided I'm just not going to be able to do this right. Like, I would have to quit everything that I was doing to actually be able to fully manage my autoimmune disease with just the autoimmune protocol because of that stress piece. And I'm not ready to do that. I have more books I want to write. I have more resources I want to create. Like, I feel like what I'm doing is really important.
Yeah.
So I would say generally working with a functional medicine specialist to be able to compensate for some of those choices and be able to dial things in and dig deeper. There's things that I've been able to do with my functional medicine specialist that I never would have been able to do by myself.
I think it's interesting when people ask that question. And I've been doing this almost 8 years. And for me, when I think about how I felt or how I would feel if I wasn't doing the lifestyle aspects, I think it's hard for me to remember how bad it was. What's interesting is when I got gluten a couple of months ago, and not just like a little bit of gluten, like on the cruise cross-contamination or whatever, like when I went through the process of actually consuming a substantial quantity of gluten and having an anaphylactic reaction and that whole thing, I mean, I was bedridden with joint pain. Like, it was, and not from a back injury, just like, oh my gosh, I would have like early onset arthritis. I would have incredible headaches and brain fog and all of these things that were happening to me. And I think, you know, when you consider what, you know, why isn't AIP enough or why isn't paleo enough? Why do all these other things? Like, well, think about how, what it is taking care of, you know what I mean? Like, all of the inflammation and the problems that it is taking care of. Like, instead of focusing on, but it didn't get me 100% of the way, it only got me 90% of the way. Like, how about thinking, it got me 90% of the way? Like, that's amazing. So, okay.
All right.
Cool. Any other questions on Instagram? We're going to keep going on Facebook.
Not really.
Okay.
What are your tips for someone starting due to an autoimmune disease?
So we said we were going to do this rapid fire, and we haven't really been doing rapid fire. So what are my tips for someone
just
starting?
Let's assume somebody who's just new to the idea of diet and lifestyle changes for autoimmune disease, all the way back there. Not someone paleo needing to do AIP, but somebody who's like, oh, food can help. Let me learn more.
Yeah. So I would say check out our book. Real Life Paleo. That's what I would say. For me, baby steps worked, and we outline how to do that. And it goes from, you know, you can make it 1 week, you can make it 1 month, you can make it 1 year, like whatever the pacing is for you. But I just think that for most people that do it all at once, it ends up not being sustainable. It ends up being overwhelming. I know you're a little bit different. You jumped in all at once. But I think, you know, I hear from so many people that it's seen as kind of a short-term solution, or it becomes so hard and unmanageable that they give up and they don't do it all the way. And so I think it's a matter of prioritizing in whatever aspect you need to, like, what are your goals? What are you trying to accomplish? And what are the things that you're committed to doing for yourself? And it's really important, in my opinion, to say that you're doing this for you, and to think of it as like a positive approach to loving yourself, respecting yourself, and getting to where you want to be, because that thought process is so much more impactful, in my opinion, than saying, oh, I have to do this because of this terrible thing that I have. And if you approach it that way, then it becomes such a burden and such a negative frustration that it's more difficult to want to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I generally recommend that people, with autoimmune disease, there's always this extra caveat of sometimes people are so sick that the illness sort of robs them of that gradual transition option. But I generally recommend people transition in whatever way they've been successful making change before in the past. So if they're really great at making a New Year's resolution and sticking to it for the full year, then they're people who can just jump in. If they're people who buy that gym pass January 1st and it's already gathering dust by January 20th, maybe gradual baby steps. I mean, my number one recommendation is to educate yourself. So work on, you know, starting to learn the whys behind a lot of this stuff. I'm a person who, understanding why a food is going to help my body heal versus why another food is going to actually, you know, activate my immune system more. I find that understanding that actually helps me make better choices and be more consistent in what I do. But there's a lot to learn with the autoimmune protocol. So, you know, like, it doesn't need to be all at once. You can gradually increase your learning. I've got tons of free resources on my website, and I've got lots of great, you know, three of my books are autoimmune protocol books, and I have this course that's designed for that sort of more deep dive into the whys behind it. But you can sort of gradually work on that. And you can take, you know, gluten-free as a step. You can take paleo as a step. You can do this iteratively. The other thing that I would recommend is focusing on what you do get to eat rather than what you will miss. That's really important just from a mindset perspective. And so one of the things I always like to do when people are like struggling to stick with paleo or the autoimmune protocol is like, what meal do you already eat that is either already AIP or paleo, whichever we're working towards, or that could be very easily with a really simple swap. So do you like roast chicken? Yes. It's like super easy.
Steak.
Do you like steak?
Eggs, yes. And bacon. Well, not for AIP, but yeah.
But bacon.
Yeah.
Do you like roasted vegetables? Right? Do you like a salad? I mean, with AIP, you're saying that salad can't have tomatoes. But, like, other than that, if a meal was made of those things, would you enjoy that meal? Yes. And there's usually several meals that people have already in their normal rotation that is either really close, it's just swapping out for a better quality salad dressing, or it's using coconut aminos instead of soy sauce. Like, it's a simple little switch. So look at those meals that you already consume on a regular basis that are already compliant, and make more of your meals look like that, and sort of let the good foods that you get to eat that are really good healing foods, let those just kind of displace the other stuff. So focus on just eating more of the good stuff rather than super honing in on eliminations, at least at first, right? Like, with AIP, eliminations become a really important step, but it doesn't have to be the first step. And then the last tip I have is to focus on sleep, because when you're getting enough sleep, your hunger's regulated, you're not having cravings, you're more motivated to move, your stress is better regulated, so your body's going to respond better to big changes in diet. So there's some gastrointestinal, some digestive shift that can happen with big changes in diet, and there's also some metabolism shifts that can happen. If you're getting enough sleep, those will be easier. And it'll just be easier to eat different food and to not eat food that you love and miss. So getting enough sleep is really, it really helps support the choice aspect of sticking to it.
And I would say prepare everything in your house, whether it's paleo or autoimmune. Like, don't have things that are going to tempt you. If you're talking about tips, like, just, you know, even if it's like jerky with paprika, if you're trying to go AIP, like, there's so many different things that you need to look into. Like, just set yourself up for success with putting everything in your home that will help you succeed.
I do.
You have a question on Instagram saying, would taking thyroid replacement at night to mimic the circadian rhythm of a normally functioning thyroid be an option
we should consider? You did a good job reading the question.
I am gonna read.
I'm so glad, 12-year-old.
Actually, it better mimic circadian rhythm to take thyroid first thing in the morning, which is why that's the typical recommendation. The other thing about thyroid hormone is that it is almost everything interferes with its absorption, so you really need to take it on an empty stomach with a little bit of water, not a ton of water, and not have anything, not even black coffee, for like an hour afterwards, so you can absorb as much of it as possible. And it's, most people do not have an empty enough stomach in the evening to be able to absorb thyroid hormone very efficiently. So it actually, you know, think of it, thyroid hormone regulates metabolism. Your metabolism increases during the day when you're active. So it is much more it's much more aligned with our circadian rhythms to take it first thing in the morning.
You going to take that question then?
Yeah. That one can be a rapid fire.
Okay.
View on zero-carb meat-only diet.
You need vegetables.
Vegetables are really important.
We actually did a whole podcast on why vegetables are really important, especially if you're eating a lot of meat. So check that out.
Yeah. You know, we actually tackled that question not necessarily from the meat-only side, although we had sort of questions in our queue about that, but from the how really important are vegetables side. And they're absolutely critical for health. You are missing not only vital nutrients on the meat-only diet, even if you're eating things like adrenal glands for the vitamin C, there's phytochemicals are something we can only get from plants. That's what phyto means, plant. And even though they aren't necessarily like you will die if you don't have them, we know they're critical for health. They're antioxidant, they're anti-cancer, they're cardioprotective.
Even if you're eating grass-fed. Like, yeah. Don't convince yourself that that's the argument.
Well, and the other issue is the fiber. So these very low-carb diets, meat-only diets, obviously those ketogenic diets, if they don't provide enough fiber to support a healthy and diverse gut microbiome. And we know now from studies that the loss of diversity in gut bacteria over several weeks of following these very low-carbohydrate diets is irreversible. So it's similar to antibiotics in the sense that you lose biodiversity in your gut microbiome and you can't get it back. So I am very, very adamant that meat-only diets is a bad, bad idea.
More questions?
Do you have another rapid-fire question?
Yeah.
Thoughts on fasting?
So I personally did fasting for quite a while. And
you did intermittent fasting.
Yes, I did.
Let's differentiate. Yes. Because water fasting and long-term fasting is gaining a little bit more traction in our community, so let's make sure to differentiate.
Yes. No, I did not do fasting. I did intermittent fasting. And for me, what I learned after doing it for a few months and really having detrimental health results is that without a gallbladder, which means that's how my body accumulates bile. Look, I'm talking with my hands. People can see it. Body accumulates.
I just realized that my arm looks really good in your Instagram, and I'm, like, solely distracted by my arm.
It really does.
Look at how, toned that is.
Yep.
I'm, like, really pleased with my arm right now.
Anyway, so the bile is not being accumulated in the gallbladder in order to help digest the big meal that you eat, like, basically once or twice a day when you intermittent fast. So for me, I know I have a lot of people that don't have gallbladders. Like, it's not a good solution for you, in my opinion. I'll let you take it from a different perspective.
All right. So the rationale behind intermittent fasting is that it stimulates autophagy, which is like a spring cleanup in your cells. And it does do that. But I think it's really important to emphasize that it's not the only thing that stimulates autophagy. So we stimulate autophagy just by getting enough sleep. We stimulate autophagy by exercising. So we don't need to intermittent fast in order to have the spring cleanup in our cells. That being said, I mean, we should not be eating while we're asleep. Like, that's, if you're eating while you're sleeping, it's a problem. Cole, do you do that? Cole looked a little guilty right there. No, so we shouldn't be eating while we're asleep, right? Our body has other priorities other than digesting food, and we know from the research that eating before bed, again, it sort of revs up our metabolism and erodes our sleep quality. And so ideally we would have our last meal of the day 4 to 5 hours before we go to bed at night. That's sort of optimal for sleep quality. So if you actually sleep 8 hours and you don't eat for 4 hours before you go to bed, there's 12 hours right there. And that is enough to start to get some of those autophagy benefits. So, you know, this whole idea of intermittent fasting and having these sort of truncated windows of time in which we actually get our meals, it's sort of driving that to a point that's not necessary for most people. And the other sort of aspect of this is if you have any kind of stress, and, you know, if your stress axis is not working right, which is like most people, it can really backfire. So you really only get the benefits of intermittent fasting when you're a very healthy person who's active with well-managed stress, and really mostly if you're just male. Like, females generally are not going to respond the same way to it. So I just sort of recommend this more gentle version of, like, don't eat for a few hours before bed and get enough sleep. Don't feel like you have to rush to eat breakfast in the morning. If you work out in the morning, feel free to eat afterwards. You don't have to cram breakfast in before you work out. And like, that's a really gentle way to do it. That's not going to stimulate a stress response.
I would say too, like, for most people, if you're moving to a real foods-based diet and you're not eating a lot of refined carbohydrates, you might find that you just skip some meals sometimes because you're not hungry and your body is just sustaining itself. And that's total. I mean, to me, that's kind of the rhythm that you want to be in with your body, is like, you know, knowing what you need when you need. And I think for some people, for intermittent fasting, what I've found for myself and what I've heard from other people is that it can work really well in the beginning, and then you kind of overeat during the certain meals, and so you're not really getting the benefits that you might be wanting out of it anyway. So after you've been doing it a while, you know, I if you feel really strongly about it, just make sure that you're watching your hormones and that kind of thing and not creating more of an issue.
I saw a really interesting talk at a conference a few years ago about how the body responds to stochastic signals, so basically randomness.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really about the benefits of having the occasional day where you don't eat, or having the occasional day where you have very low carb, or having the occasional day where you go for a 12-mile hike when that's an unusual activity for you, and very much sort of mixing it up, which of course is like the CrossFit philosophy, right? You never adjust to anything because you do something different every time you go to the gym. And it was a really interesting talk about how this can actually, you know, stimulate some sort of hormetic, it's sort of adaptations in the body and potentially improve longevity. So I think there's a little bit to be said for having some random signals. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there's certain things that we know are circadian rhythm entrenchers. So they're going to really, really help the body prioritize functions. So we know that, you know, being outside, like light and dark are really important. So there's some things that you don't want. You don't want to be like randomly turning on a spotlight in your bedroom at midnight. That would not be a good stochastic process.
Sarah, tell us a joke.
All right. Why did the pig's kitchen smell so good? Because she was bacon.
So let me just tell you how many jokes I've had to hear while I'm here.
Have you heard that one yet?
No.
All right. So a mushroom walks into a bar.
No!
And the bartender says, "We don't serve your kind here." And the mushroom says, "Why not? I'm a fun guy."
Okay, we're moving on. More questions.
You should tell me a joke.
Coming over here on Instagram.
Oh, this was a follow-up, so I'd have to find the first
I think
half
we really,
question.
Like, answered it.
All right. Please explain the benefits of finding out if you have MTHFR, if you have Graves' disease. There's actually a benefit to finding out if you have MTHFR gene variants that will affect the function of that enzyme. If you have autoimmune disease or autoimmune disease in your family, we know that it's a risk gene for autoimmune disease. And it basically impacts a variety of systems. So it impacts liver detoxification, it impacts neurotransmitter regulation, it impacts the stress axes, because these all have enzymes that are turned on or off through methylation. And methylation is also a really important process in phase 2 liver detoxification. And finding out if you have that, there are supplements that you can take to help support those systems. So again, it's sort of like work with a functional medicine specialist, depending on which mutations you have, depending on some of the function of other related enzymes, different methylated B vitamins are recommended or contraindicated. So getting into those nitty-gritty details with a functional medicine specialist is really helpful. But it really is a good one to know, because there is supplements to help support the system, and because when you're not methylating properly, it really does impact how your body responds to diet and lifestyle choices, and it really will hold you back from healing if you have those alleles, unfortunately. That was rapid fire. I was really proud of that. All right, we're warming up now. What do you guys think about keto? I think I just answered that.
Especially that person in particular said they didn't have a gallbladder, and so I think, you know, to emphasize, it's really, you can't do high fat if you don't have a gallbladder, because you don't have the necessary components in your body to break down the fat of the individual meals that you'll be eating. So
I think keto is an inherently nutrient deficient approach, and the science does not bear out either its efficacy or its safety. So I only would advocate keto for somebody with neurodegenerative disease who has tried other options first. And that's really in the science, the only thing that we see is consistently helped by keto. As a weight loss approach, it has been debunked in the scientific literature. It provides no metabolic advantage over a, you know, moderate carb, moderate fat, moderate protein approach. And it can actually make you more insulin resistant and leptin resistant. It can really mess up. It can cause really messed up impacts on sex hormones. Women tend to lose their periods on it. So most women are not actually doing keto to become infertile, weirdly. It's not, it's just like a side benefit. Oh, by the way, you're infertile now. And it doesn't support gut health. It doesn't provide enough fiber to support gut health. I don't recommend it at all, pretty much, other than for this one small group of people for whom the science is pretty strong.
And I think what's interesting to me is the definition of keto is a little bit different for everybody. I mean, true keto does not take into consideration net carbs. It doesn't take into consideration fiber offsets. Like when you look at the way Atkins was, for example, Atkins said basically anything that you were eating that was carbohydrate based in fiber didn't count towards your carbohydrates. And so if you're doing true keto, that's not the definition. So I think, you know, when people say, but I'm doing keto and it works for me, but I'm, you know, not counting vegetable carbohydrate, like, great.
You're probably eating a healthy diet.
Exactly. Like, that's paleo. So I just wanted to kind of normalize that, because I think a lot of people use the word keto to represent low carb, and that's not what it means. A ketogenic diet is different than that. It's an incredibly high fat, moderate protein, no carb diet.
And one of the other things to sort of emphasize here is a flexible metabolism is one that will use whatever fuel is there. So after a meal, it will use sugar because you will have consumed some carbohydrates with your meal. Between meals, a flexible metabolism will use fat for energy, and it'll switch back and forth really, really easily. It is completely normal to be in ketosis when you wake up in the morning. So I've had my blood drawn first thing in the morning, and there's ketones in my blood because I haven't eaten since dinner the night before. I'm fasted now. It is perfectly normal. It's a sign of a healthy metabolism to be in ketosis in the morning. So we actually do kind of dip in and out. The difference is sustained ketosis really creates a very rigid metabolism in the same, or sort of like in an almost opposite way to how having diabetes is a very rigid metabolism. We just don't have a name for it because you have to try really hard to be in a ketogenic diet, whereas you just have to eat delicious sugar to make yourself diabetic. But a lot of delicious sugar, like on a regular basis. But a flexible metabolism is one that uses whatever fuel is there. And the way you achieve a flexible metabolism is by getting enough sleep, by being active, by eating moderate carb, moderate fat, moderate protein, and having distinct meals. So getting away from grazing, but having a meal and having some space in between. That's really, really important for giving our bodies the opportunity to get into that fat burning stage between meals.
Okay, keep going.
All right. I kind of have a feeling there's like 50 more questions here.
Yeah. I think we've talked about.
Ooh. Healthy pregnancy with Hashis. Definitely make sure your thyroid hormone is dialed in and be very, very closely monitored. So make sure you're working with an obstetrician who will do a lot of blood testing, because being pregnant messes around with your thyroid hormones. You don't want to be all of a sudden hyper, but you don't want to be hypo. Both of those things increase risk of bad things happening during pregnancy. So, you know, major tips, be very, very closely monitored, have very open conversations with your healthcare providers. That's number one tip. And then, like, the normal stuff, like nutrient density, get enough rest, relax.
And I would say, too, one of the other things that just remind people of with pregnancy is the standard recommendations for pregnancy supplements, like folate instead of folic acid and different things like that. Like, make sure that you're aware of the nutrients that you're eating and the density of them, and consider that when you're being told by someone who might not be thinking full picture to take certain supplements and the effects that some of that stuff has is not necessarily what you might want. So I'm not a medical professional, but I know for me, even when I was pregnant with Wesley and I wasn't like nearly as, well, I wasn't really educated at all, I did know the difference between folate and folic acid and ended up going on kind of, you know, cocktail of different things that was more specific than like a general pregnancy pill. And I don't know if it's better now than it was 8 years ago, but
the folic acid is still in a lot of the pregnancy multivitamins. And especially if you have MTHFR, you don't want to take
exactly.
folic acid.
Yeah.
So there's actually in Paleo Principles, there's a whole section on nutrition during pregnancy and lactation, as well as a whole page on like what's the difference between folic acid and folate and who should not take folic acid. So the short form is folic acid is better absorbed than folate, but it's a multi-step process in the body to convert it into L-methylfolate, which is the active form of folate. Whereas the folate we get from food is typically fewer steps, including there's some already L-methylfolate in our food. And so even though it's not quite as easily absorbed, it's more bioavailable. So it's more, it's fewer steps for our body to convert it into the active form. And the rate-limiting enzyme that's responsible for that final step into L-methylfolate, methyl, is MTHFR. So if you have an MTHFR variant that's inhibiting function, you're not going to convert folic acid into L-methylfolate very well, and having high folic acid in the blood increases risk of cancer. So that's why it's really, really bad for people with MTHFR gene variants to take folic acid.
Okay, keep going.
Whew. What happened to my YouTube show?
Life?
Yeah, life, money. Nobody wanted it.
They wanted it. That's.
I mean, they wanted it. It's expensive.
Someone asked for you, smile.
Oh, it's hard. We see, we normally do this, like, in our pajamas.
Yeah, and honestly, like, it's pretty late, and I had a long day. My back is starting to, like, not feel so great after sitting in the chair. Yeah. So that's why I'm not smiling.
We have, how do you absorb fats after getting your gallbladder out? So you have sort of dietary choices that you use mm-hmm. to manage yours.
Yeah.
The other option is to take ox bile or bile salt.
Well, and I started that way. I did it for, not right after my gallbladder was removed because it took me years to figure out what was going on, but I did take multiple supplements, both HCL and ox bile, for probably about 2 years total, 18 months, I started weaning myself off when I started learning how to eat and what my body wanted and how to properly absorb what I was eating and all that kind of stuff. So some people take them their whole lives, and there's nothing wrong with that. Like, you don't have a gallbladder to make that anymore. Like, there's no issue, just like with taking thyroid medication, to take a bile supplement. For me, it was just a pain in the butt to always have it, and I wanted to not have to spend the money and time and all that kind of stuff. So,
oh, that's my gym owner. Hi, Jake.
Hi. Jake joined like 40 minutes ago.
I know. Sure. He's probably totally not on now. Yeah. He's probably like, oh, whatever Sarah's doing. I'm working out in the morning, Jake. That's what I'm doing. What do you think about extremely high doses of probiotics for IBD UC? So a trillion a day with yeah, I mean, actually, VisBiome, VSL3, also their doses now in the 3-4 trillion a day range. I was at a conference last weekend in Chicago, and one of the other speakers said it really well. He said, it's like a monocrop, but your gut microbiome, which I thought was really a really interesting way of looking at these high dose supplements, because a normal, healthy, robust gut microbiome would have like
diversity.
500 to 1500 different species of microorganisms in it. And when you take most of these supplements, probiotic supplements, they might have 8 or 9 species. So even in the billions range, you're really hammering one species pretty hard. That being said, when you have something that wipes out, you know, like ulcerative colitis or, you know, there's other C. difficile, you know, there's lots of other sort of infectious things that are wiping out your microbiome. You have undergrowth because nothing is staying in your digestive system for very long. At some point, you sort of need that high dose to be able to stimulate the environment to be, because what the bacteria do is, as they're fermenting, they actually create a more acidic environment, which supports the growth of more different kinds of species. So you're almost like, you're trying to get that environment started so that you can get more growing. So I don't think they're a supplement for all the food things, like eating lots of vegetables with UC. If, you know, it's flaring, you probably want cooked or pureed vegetables like smoothies and soups. But eating a lot of vegetables and seafood is really important for a healthy gut microbiome. Eating fermented foods to seed with more diversity. But there is, you know, some really good science supporting these high-dose probiotic supplements for these, you know, situations where there's just no growth of bacteria in the gut. So you can't get that gut environment started. It's almost like just trying to get over the hump to be able to have a gut environment that's going to be conducive to growing that kind of variety of wonderful little bacteria pets.
I didn't even know that it was a thing that you could run out of time on Instagram Live.
Whoa, you can?
You got,
I guess that means
got
we podcasted
seconds.
Enough. Bye, Instagram. I mean, do we want to quickly do an Instagram question here?
I don't know what Stratagene by Ben Lynch.
I think we should read that one. You both look amazing after a long day.
Laura's very generous.
She's my favorite person right now.
So, those of you on Instagram, thanks for tuning in. We'll probably wrap up over on Sarah's Facebook page, and you can listen to the whole podcast on the Paleo
with all the stupid things edited out, right?
Let's hope. On the Paleo View this coming Friday, and probably next Friday we'll probably
this will probably be a two episode. We've been doing this for a while. This will probably be a two episoder.
But thank you so much for all of you who hung in and asked questions on Instagram.
Oh, and Laura gave us hearts.
Yes, because Laura's the best. Hi.
Bye, Instagram. Hi, Facebook. I think Facebook's gonna have to do this for like the next 7 or 8 hours.
I'm still here too.
Oh, Cole, come photobomb properly.
It's my Coley.
This is Cole. Cole's been like the big mature 12-year-old.
He went and got some charging bricks for us, doing all kinds of stuff behind the scenes.
Can I switch over to Facebook?
I think we're doing all right, buddy.
Yeah. So, this one. After reintroducing, I've become severely allergic to oranges. Any idea why after 46 years this allergy would all of a sudden show up? So the reason why elimination and challenge diets are so effective, which is what the autoimmune protocol is because they exaggerate reactions that are already there and allow it to be more easily identified. So what happens when you cut out a food that you're having a food allergy sensitivity intolerance to out of your diet for a while, the body sort of has these like protective mechanisms to restrain the reaction. And sometimes those protective mechanisms will be strong enough to restrain the reaction to the point where you feel crummy. And there's obviously a reason why you went on an elimination diet like Paleo or the autoimmune protocol in the first place. But it keeps the system sort of dialed in so that it won't get so crazy out of control. When you eliminate that, those protective mechanisms go away. So then when you challenge the food and you eat it again, there's nothing holding that reaction in. So the reaction becomes much more magnified. And that's why these diets work. That's why they're still the gold standard for allergists to identify allergies. We've talked on the show relatively recently about how allergy tests all have substantial false negative and false positive rates, no matter what allergy test you do or food intolerance test. So at the end of the day, that's why these diets work so well, because they help you identify an allergy that was there all along. It didn't make the allergy. It can feel that way at times, but it really unmasks a reaction that was there the whole time.
It was a good explanation.
Thanks, man.
Even though I was distracted by multiple things.
I assume that was something you said 45 minutes ago. Do all women have rising TSH levels during pregnancy, or just those with hypothyroidism? Actually, all women do. It's just that in a normal system, you've got this feedback with the pituitary gland. So the pituitary gland will then go like, oh, we don't, you know, it's a negative feedback loop. So as you produce more, the pituitary gland produces TSH. TSH stimulates the release of thyroid hormone from the thyroid. The thyroid tells the pituitary gland that's enough TSH. Everything gets dialed up a bit during pregnancy, but those feedback loops are still working. If you have Hashimoto's thyroiditis or Graves' disease, that communication, that cycle is broken.
So she followed up by asking if there's also common mineral and vitamin deficiencies and how important is selenium?
Oh, hypothyroidism? Crazy important. So it's actually selenoenzymes that are responsible for the conversion of T4 to T3. So you really need selenium in order to have active thyroid hormone. Iodine deficiency can cause hypothyroidism. So just having, and actually super iodine excess can cause it too. So having crazy levels of iodine in either direction can cause massive problems with thyroid function. Iron is also really important for thyroid function, and so is zinc. So those are like the four minerals that are really, really important. And if you are deficient in any one of those, that can impact thyroid function.
We're getting kind of close. Just a couple more.
Oh, sweet. How much thyroid hormone replacement do you take? Just curious. Can I just say a lot? Super a lot.
I don't talk about the specifics of what I take.
I take now, I started with natural desiccated. I now take compounded slow release bioidentical with a 1-to-2 ratio of T3 to T4 as opposed to the normal 1-to-4 ratio. I'm a terrible converter. And I take a very high dose. I'm gonna leave it there. I think that's a lot of details right there.
Ultimately you worked for a long time with the medical profession and will come up with a solution that worked for you.
Yeah, and we're still tinkering. I've been AIP for 10 months, have lost weight initially, but can't seem to lose weight the last 6 months. I'm about 20 pounds overweight. I don't eat a lot of AIP treats. I don't know what happens if I said Seymour.
Yet. It just says, I know I'll feel better.
Oh yeah. You sure? I think that's my first question. I think most of the time when I'm talking with people who say they want to lose 20 pounds, they actually should not lose 20 pounds. So I have a blog post on my site. If you even just go to start here and find there's like a weight loss, like healthy weight loss tab right in the under start here now that will get you this information and bring you to more details. But I have a post now about goal setting and looking at body composition goals. And so tracking body composition rather than absolute weight or rather than BMI is really, really important when you're setting weight loss goals. But also what we see from the medical literature is that especially for women, but for men too, is having a little bit more stored body fat is actually protective for us in the long run. So what is sort of generally recommended by medical professionals of, you know, this is how much you should weigh, it's actually a little bit underweight what is the healthiest for all of us. So that's my first question is, you might actually be a perfect weight right now, which, I mean, sucks if you have a certain sense of what you want to look like in a bikini, if that's not where you're at. But if you're somebody who's been battling autoimmune disease, you've probably already come around to health is the most important thing. So I would definitely recommend checking out that post, getting a scale that will do impedance so you have a sense of body composition. They're not as accurate as what a doctor will measure, but they'll give you a good sense. And tracking body composition instead of absolute weight or instead of BMI. And then from that, you know, things that can be holding back weight loss if you really do have that weight to lose is inadequate sleep, stress, hypothyroidism, sex hormone imbalances, eating too much. So if you're, it's harder to do on the AIP. We see it more people are doing paleo, but just getting more into those hyperpalatable foods, vitamin D deficiency. I'm all kung fu fighting over here.
Cole is mocking Sarah's hand motions.
My mom didn't want to do hand motions, but Sarah's.
I never said at the beginning of this that I was going to avoid hand motions.
Yeah, no, my mom. Was.
I cannot speak without my hands.
No, I mean, how could you? I possibly convey my thoughts to you if you didn't see my hands.
It's this is where the words come out.
The other thing that I want to say to Amy, and you kind of touched on it, but to me, AIP is not a weight loss diet. AIP is a healing, nutrient-dense, anti-inflammatory approach to healing. And weight loss is a wonderful side effect, especially for those that need it for their health. But the idea of I've been doing AIP for 10 months and I you have 20 more pounds to lose. I just want to make sure we're all on the same page that while weight loss is one of the benefits, it's not the goal of AI. Like, you didn't write the Paleo Approach as a weight loss book, right? So I just want to put that out there. And I'm glad that you said what you said, because even I've read in popular social articles and whatever that they find that the people who live the longest have an extra 10, 20 pounds on them, because when they get the flu or when they fall on their hip, there's a little bit of padding or, you know, whatever.
The best place to be in terms of long-term health is right at the top of the normal weight range, bordering between the top of the normal weight range and overweight. That's sort of where that's like the sweet spot. So just like, and measuring that by body fat composition, and what that means, what that translates to depends on your age. So for me, I think it translates to being sort of between 27 and 31% body fat is the translation of being in that sweet spot, which is I'm in that range. I'm happy in that range. So that's why this post actually gives you like the mathematical formula to like figure out what the range is for you. And then, you know, those body comp scales now are really inexpensive.
Okay. I think that was the one I already read you.
Disadvantages of cheating when eating paleo AIP.
So can I just say that I don't like the word cheating? Like, you're making a choice. And AIP, it's different than
paleo. It sounds like
paleo.
You're married to your food.
Well, and it's like, does the food have an emotion? Like, does the food...
It will have its feelings hurt.
Right. So you're making a choice to eat a certain way for a reason. And whether you're doing it for yourself because you want to see how much better you'll feel, or because you want to lose weight with paleo, or because you're trying to heal with autoimmune, like, your goals and your mission is entirely different. And so for me, I don't cheat on AIP intentionally, but I also have reintroduced some foods that I know don't bother me. And a couple of weeks ago, I ate nightshades knowingly because I was like, oh, I'm going to see what happens. Like, I'm going to reintroduce. It's been a while. It didn't go well. but I didn't cheat on AIP. I was like, this curry that we got looks and smells amazing, and I don't have anything happening in the next week that would, you know, be impacted if my joints started hurting and my face blew up with acne, which are the things that happened to me immediately with nightshades. So I really don't like the word cheat, and I would like us to think of a word that does not place emotional value on food when we're talking about making a choice to eat something off of a prescribed list. Like, this whole thing is about finding a template that works for you based on your goals and based on your body. And so if you're going to go to the pizza buffet and fall face first into, yes, whatever it is,
Wesley face palm,
right, then yeah, that's not the, like, the health choice, right? That's, is that an emotional choice? Is that whatever? And, like, why are you making it? If you want to make it, like, make the choice and move, you know, like, move on. Don't have guilt and blah, blah, blah. So, anyway, that's my soapbox about that.
Yeah.
Now this person's totally regretting using the word cheat.
I'm going to go beyond the language and answer the heart of the question, which is, it really depends. So, it depends on what you're eating that is off plan. And it depends on how much, and it depends on how often, and it depends on your individual sensitivity to those foods. It depends on your stress level, how much sleep you're getting, how nutrient-dense your diet is, what chronic health conditions you're challenged with. It depends on your genetics. So it can range from complete, you know, like, destroying the gut lining that takes 6 months to heal.
Anaphylactic reaction.
Anaphylaxis type reactions. It can range from something that's a life-threatening flare that puts you in the hospital, to it was fine. It did nothing. It just wasn't the most nutrient-dense choice that you could have made at that moment. And everything in between. So this is where we were talking about how it's so much easier to travel once you've been on this journey long enough to start playing with the boundaries of what your body tolerates. You know, this going off plan, I didn't use the C word, cheat. Okay, just making sure. these can be seen as opportunities to learn about your body. I think one of the really important things here is if you are someone who battles with chronic illness, you're not going to learn as much as if you do reintroductions methodically. Doing methodical reintroductions is the best way to really isolate how your body is responding to something.
Pizza is not methodical, because that's never gluten, methodical. Tomatoes, and dairy,
it's all
friends.
The things. Bad oils. Yeah, it's all the things.
All the things. And
so being methodical is really important, especially for someone who's battling with chronic illness. And it's also important not to let these moments of indulgence derail effort. So it's okay to choose to cheat. We all cheat. I did it. It's okay to
choose. I literally bit my lip when you said
to
it.
To choose to indulge. Can we say choose to indulge?
It's okay to make a choice. Period. It's a choice. Like it's whether it's, you know, on a list of foods or not. But you have to understand, based on exactly all the things that Sarah's saying, what the reaction to your body is and what your goals are, and asking yourself why you're doing it. I think one of the things that when someone says about cheating, the question that I have is like, well, what's your goal? Is your goal that you're, you know, filling an emotional void with a food that you know isn't good for you? Or, you know, do you have a family event where participating in your grandmother's dinner is brings you joy and fills you emotionally in a positive way, and you would like to participate in that, and therefore you're going to, you know, do that? And then what are the best ways to recover from that? I think those are kind of more how I approach it or how I think about it. And I think, you know, the idea of cheating to me is just, you're making the choice. It's your body, it's your food choices, and you need to decide like what the goals are and what you're trying to accomplish. Yeah. And so if something is going to derail you from your goals, make a different choice or understand that it's going to derail you and plan for recovery.
And I just sort of want to add, don't let making a suboptimal choice, don't let that give you permission
to snowball into
all the bad choices.
Yeah, because if you fill yourself with guilt and it becomes this whole thing, and then you're like, well, I did this, so I might as well do this. And then, you know, 3 weeks later, you're, you know, completely undid the progress that you've made, you know? So it's like, you have to know yourself and your limitations. And I mean, Sarah and I were just talking about this today. Like, we know our trigger foods and, you know, what we can tolerate, what we can't tolerate, or things that aren't necessarily the best for us but don't derail us, and maybe not surrounding ourselves with those foods very often. You know, different things like that. And it takes a long time to learn yourself and your bodies. And
this was in the context of me saying that potato chips, if I have a handful, I feel fine, but they're like a binge food for me and I can't help myself and I eat the whole bag, and that much salt makes my ankle swell and it's really bad. So we all have these kinds of challenges that we have to, like, this is as much an emotional and mental health journey as it is a physical health journey. And I think it's really important for us to stay centered on that fact.
Right. I'm going to answer a question.
Wait, you got to answer it into the microphone so that it's recorded.
Cole's going to answer a question.
It's not really a question.
Okay.
Somebody said you should do more video podcasts. That would mean we would have to take a drive down to Georgia. And I'm not going to do that.
You don't want to come visit me, like, every other weekend?
It's just, cramped up it's with the car like, with those people 16 hours a weekend taking away my time.
You know
time.
What? If you just came here, it would only be 9.5 hours.
Well, I think he's saying 8 hours here, 8 hours back.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Okay. 16 hours. Yeah.
Yeah.
Assuming your dad respects the speed limit. So you're saying you're not interested? As with the food I fed you wasn't good.
Listen,
enough?
I will tell you. I will tell you that I did not want to do this video podcast.
I made her.
She really did.
I set it all up and I said, "Here, sit down. Let's
do like this." She broached the idea yesterday, and I was like, "I can't do it." And then today, I was like, "I'm so tired. I don't want to do it." And she's like, "We're doing it." So at least you got this one. We try. Every time we're together, we do try to do something.
We do generally try. I mean, we see each other approximately once to twice per year. So we do try, but it's not an easy thing to do, like just a, I don't know how we would even do this.
I know that some people do, you know, Skype videos and they do them live and recorded or whatever. And I just don't think that would work for us the way that we do it and we time it based on our lives and kids and me having a full-time job, all that kind of stuff. Like, we have to make this work the way that it works. And that's audio most
that's
of the time.
That's too bad we don't live closer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
All right.
Maybe we'll take one more. I think we're almost to the...
I know, but people keep asking
that
more
one,
questions.
I feel like
this was just a quick... taking thyroid hormone once in the morning and then once in midday. My functional medicine specialist did have me do this for a while before I moved to slow release. So there are some people who burn through thyroid hormone really quickly so that by midday they've already used up everything they took in the morning. So for those people, it can really help even out energy. So yes, there is some utility. Again, work with a functional medicine specialist or a really savvy endocrinologist. I can't say that word now. Endocrinologist to be able to dial that in, but going to slow release is another option sort of beyond that. All right, look at all these people saying hello.
Hi.
And thank you, and oh goodness, there's so many good questions in here.
I looked at it earlier, those like last six weren't there.
Oh, look at this person said, and it's Lori, said one of the best things was my AAP lecture series.
Yay.
Thanks, Lori. Lori was in my inaugural January class. All right. So I think this will be the last question because
sure.
It's from Lori, who was in my inaugural
awesome.
Class, right? How do x-rays impact autoimmune disease? So one of the reasons why when you get an x-ray, you wear the lead on your neck, like if you're getting your teeth x-rays or something, is because the thyroid is particularly sensitive to x-rays, as are ovaries. So that's one of the reasons why, like if you have a kid who's getting, their leg x-rayed because they might have broken, they first ask if you might be expecting, and then you say, no. And then you panic a little bit because you're not sure all of a sudden, even though like obviously the answer is no. This is what happens to every mother, right? And then they give you the apron and then they give you the neck guard. The neck guard is to protect your thyroid. So certain organs are very sensitive to x-rays in terms of their function. Thyroid is one. Ovaries are another. But we don't really see issues with x-ray and autoimmune disease except in people who are getting a lot of occupational exposure.
Mm-hmm.
So getting an x-ray once in a while because something bad might happen to you and we need to find out, it's not going to generally aggravate disease. And Cole is making fun of my gesticulations again.
It's pretty awesome, actually.
So... I think that's my best answer for that question.
So I'll just state for the record that I fly and I go through the machine.
I do too.
Yeah. It's not a concern that I have based on the information that I know with the moderate exposure.
Those machines don't use x-rays.
Yeah, but they do some sort of...
It's millimeter wavelength.
Yeah, yeah.
It's different.
There's wavelengths involved.
They're light! It's non-ionizing radiation. The reason why x-rays can be problematic is because it is potentially ionizing radiation. What they use in airports for TSA screening is non-ionizing radiation. It's as harmless as a microwave, and microwaves are harmless, by the way.
We did do a show on that.
Yeah.
We feel pretty passionately about it.
Unless you put a spoon in it.
Years and years ago, we had this ebook that we were going to create of just paleo microwave.
It was
going to
be called Five Minute Paleo.
Yeah, and there was going to be a whole lot of science about why microwaves are fine.
I wrote that science,
Did you?
I totally did.
Did you do a blog post on it?
I have like a 4,000 word blog post on why microwaves are totally safe.
Yeah, probably because she was prepping for the ebook and I probably bailed.
Oh, that's the end.
It'll keep going.
Maybe.
Why would your internet have gone wonky?
I don't know. I guess that's the universe saying that was enough podcast for us.
Yeah, so let's just wrap up the podcast before it comes back and then we can tell those people goodbye.
All right.
Well, thank you for tuning in to the Paleo View. This has been part 2 of 2.
Yeah. At some point, we broke this into part 1.
And if you... made it all the way through, then thank you. And of course, you can still go see the video on the Paleo Moms Facebook.
You guys can talk to them on my phone.
It's okay, boom. If you'd like to see the video, you can still see it on the Paleo Moms Facebook. Okay, guys, clearly it's time.
Yeah, that was the universe saying it's bedtime.
Definitely.
But thanks for joining us and making this such a fun, like, we really do enjoy the opportunity to have these more sort of like a live interactive shows. Even though it doesn't fit into our regularly scheduled programming.
And you can see she really does know everything.
I didn't know one question today.
That's true. And it was like, what was the first one?
It was like the first question you stumped me. So there you go. I had to make up for it after that.
Yeah.
So thanks everyone for tuning in, asking such great questions. And, if you don't already subscribe to the Paleo View, go subscribe to the Paleo View on iTunes or Stitcher and, make sure to give us a rating.
It's a free iTunes, like, and you can also get it in the web.
And we're rated G, so you can listen to us with the kids around. And, yeah, check us out.
We've been doing it for 5 years, so if you haven't started yet, you got a lot of catching up to do.
There's a lot of episodes. You're going to be busy.
And we do it by topic, too. So if there's a particular topic that we referenced and you'd like to go back and listen, you always can. So thanks again for tuning in. It was great to connect with you guys.
Bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening to The Paleo View. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.